named in honor of our Blessed Mother, and by the way, her favorite prayer. She told that to Catherine Labouré, the great Saint Catherine Labouré, in 1830 when she appeared to her in Rue de Bac in Paris. And she was asked, Saint Catherine was, by her pastor, to ask Our Lady what was her favorite prayer. And Our Lady, she said, did not hesitate. She said, "O Mary, conceive without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." So the name of the show is Our Recourse, named in honor again of our Immaculate Mother. We have a wonderful show for you today and a very special guest. His name is Tim Murnane. Many of you know who Tim is. He is the husband of Mary Jane. He is they have been married, I think, 46 or 47 years. I forget which. He is the father of 9, the grandfather of 24. All of the 9 are not only faithfully active in the church, but are really on fire in their own way for the faith, which, you know, it baffles me how any parent can do that today. But Tim and Mary Jane have somehow found a way to get that done. Tim is also the chairman of Regina Academies, and many of you know about the remarkable chain or network of authentically Catholic classic educational academies, pre-K through now even grade 12. And Tim is the chairman of that and the major force behind it. He's a leader in the Knights of the Immaculate here in the Mid-Atlantic region. He's active in many pro-life causes. But he's also a national authority on intelligent design. And it is in that capacity today that we welcome him. And we are really anxious to talk to him about what intelligent design is and why it's relevant for those of us who are Catholic and love our faith. Tim, welcome.
Brian, great to be with you. Thanks for that great introduction. Appreciate it very much.
Tim, you know, we've talked about this off air a number of times. Our bishops seem to be waking up to a very sad reality. And that is that our children have been poorly catechized, not for just one generation, but actually two. And even the young souls who are teaching our children, in our case, our grandchildren, the Catholic faith, have not been properly catechized. This was made known in a very surprising and bold way by an interview in the National Catholic Register just last week, where they asked this remarkably young bishop, Bishop Barron, Robert Barron, a new auxiliary bishop in Los Angeles, to comment on one of the great evangelization missions of our time. And he didn't hesitate. He said it's the new evangelization that John Paul II proclaimed and made so essential. And he said that is a re-evangelization of those who have been perhaps not properly evangelized the first time in the faith. He said, our children are not catechetically literate, in so many words. And his exact words were that the faith has been dumbed down, as he put it, his words, since the Second Vatican Council and its aftermath and the interpretation of the council documents. Long story short, he said, our kids just don't know the faith. And as a consequence, they're not able to practice the faith. They're not able to proclaim the faith. And that is one of the major reasons why we have rather fundamental and structural problems in the church today. I'd like to talk to you today, if we could, about the source of the problem, something that very, very few people would recognize, and why recent biomolecular discovery is so vitally important for the revitalization of our faith. Where did all of this start?
Well, of course, my theory is that it started with the Darwinian theory of evolution, 1859, the origin of the species. It took the church a long time to reconcile itself with that. In 1950, of course, we had Humani Generis, and the Pope gave permission for Catholics to study the issue. But since that time, the theistic evolution position in the church has become the dominant position, and that has led many to deny the existence of Adam and Eve, and then by implication, a true, actual, original sin. And of course, that's a foundational doctrine of our faith. Without that, things come apart very quickly. So there are lots of problems with catechesis, but in the end, I believe you can take them all back to the root and you'll find the struggle over this, the church's struggle over this, how to reconcile its doctrine with unguided Darwinian evolution is really the problem.
What's the root of the problem? Why would the church be so slow to this? You know, she is the patron of all science, beginning with the Augustinians, who taught you at Villanova University and taught both of us at Monsignor Bonner, and Gregor Mendel, an Augustinian, really the father of science. Why would the church, having long been a patron and a great force behind scientific discovery, be so hesitant to acknowledge what are really unequivocal biomolecular discoveries in our time?
Well, I guess that's a tough question for anyone to answer. Certainly the church would first of all say that she has no confidence in science. She has no right to rule on the truth or untruth of Darwinian evolution. However, the church has made it plain that one cannot believe in an unguided evolutionary process, and the church states that in the catechism. It falls out, you know, it falls outside the bounds of divine providence, and it simply cannot exist according to church teaching. So they can rule on principles, but they can't rule on science. And of course, the dominant science of the day says that Darwinian evolution is totally unguided and the result of random chance, and that basically life is an accident, that we're an accident. And inside the church, there's great debate on this. Father George Coyne was the Vatican director of the observatory, the Vatican Observatory, for 20 years. And when Cardinal Schoenborn sent his famous letter to the New York Times in 2005 saying that any system of thought that denies or seeks to explain away the overwhelming evidence for design in biology is ideology, not science, Father Coyne spoke up and said that even God couldn't know that man would be the result of evolution.
Oh, my God.
Therefore, and then of course, Cardinal Schoenborn, said that's ridiculous, that's fantasy. But here we see a credentialed Jesuit priest in the Catholic Church could make a statement like that, and it shows that he, of course, knows that that statement would be well received in many quarters. So there is no answer to the question except for the fact that science is science, and the church is waiting for scientists to step up and address the issue, I would say.
And there is, of course, a battle royale. There are many. Break the battle down for our listeners. So, obviously, there have been great biomolecular discoveries. All of us understand at least the drift, the trend, but maybe not so much the science behind it. And without getting too deep into it, tell us what has been discovered and the impact that that has on this Darwinian myth, actually, of evolution.
Well, there's so many lines of argumentation. Of course, it starts with the ability of Darwinian evolution to produce new creatures. Of course, there's no argument over the issue of what we call microevolution, and that is that random mutation and natural selection are active in nature. It helps nature to actually filter out the weak in its genetic pool. And no one argues over that, but of course the big battle has become whether that microevolution mechanism can do what some scientists, evolutionary scientists, say it can achieve, and that is to produce new creatures. Of course, no one knows how life began to begin with. That used to be an issue of evolution, but evolutionists now say they don't want to talk about that. They want that to be outside of evolution, because they have no clue. No one knows how life began. And that, of course, is a big issue. But then we go to the weakness of Darwinian evolution in modern times. When I talk to eighth graders, I tell them that in their lifetime, Darwin's mechanism has gone from a fairly influential potential explanation to one that's completely failed. And that's because of the mapping of the genome and the ability to map genomes of various creatures in hours instead of weeks. So they're creating tremendous amount of genetic information, tremendous amount of knowledge, and they're finding not only, they used to think there were 20,000 genes, for example, now they're thinking it could be over 100,000. They used to think that only 2% of the genome was actually functional, because they believed the rest of it was left over from the process of evolution. Now they're finding that probably 100%. They know at least 80% is functional. Michael Behe up at Lehigh University, of course, talked about the aspect of irreducible complexity and showed how all of biology, all of nature really is irreducibly complex. You can't take one little thing away because whatever it is you're studying, whether it be the eye or the blood clotting mechanism, it just won't work with one tiny little thing. It's a very, very complex thing that we're discussing. Then we move on to information, complex specified information in the DNA. They used to think it was only read by opening up the DNA and reading one side of it. Now they're finding that we not only read one side of it, we read both sides of it. We read it forward, we read it backward. In some cases, the code is actually overlapping. Now, man cannot even begin to understand how anybody could write code like that. And that specified information that creates life, incredible life, can't be, that evolutionary theory can't begin to explain how it could be true. And that's just the beginning of the line of argumentation on all these things that the book after book now is being written, and discovery after discovery makes it more difficult, not less difficult, to explain how Darwinian evolution could be true.
Didn't Darwin himself once famously say that if these kinds of things were ever discovered, the ones you just spoke of, that obviously his theory would be a myth?
Yeah, he did. There's a famous quote, I don't have it in front of me, but along those lines, that if anyone could ever show that the accumulation of small changes could not produce new types of creatures, macro information, if you can, then my theory would be useless. And that has occurred. We're at that point. But there's way too much invested. We have 150 years invested in the principle that Darwinian evolution is true, that the macro version of it, that one creature can become another creature, that a fish can become a cow and a reptile and all those kinds of thoughts along this evolutionary train.
How do those scientists, the ones that hold to the Darwinian error, defend against the obvious lack of macro category of species to be found anywhere on the universe in any part of the planet?
Well, a lot of their defense is silence, actually. They don't really address the issues. The really tough arguments, like Doug Axe, you and I met Doug Axe one time. He's the guy who studied proteins. He was originally a PhD in chemical engineering and sat in a lecture, and they were trying to explain to him that random chance could produce complex life. He says, I just don't buy that. He actually then dropped that career and got a PhD in molecular biology, and he studied proteins. And he's written papers and after paper. Worked at Oxford, was eventually asked to leave because they found that he was working on projects that were intelligent design related. But he showed that just for one protein to be assembled by accident, had a chance of 1 to the 74th power. And if you turn that into time, it would be longer than the history of the universe for 150 amino acid chain protein to be concocted in the right sequence by a sequence of accidents, and then folded in a way that it could be functional. It is impossible. When you come up with numbers like that, it's impossible. Now we're talking about in the human 100,000 or even a quarter of a million different proteins. So life is so complex that some simple process like Darwin's theory just doesn't, no longer cuts it, no longer could do that.
You know, the crime of it, and we've spoken about this, is that, we're well on our way to the truth being mainstream. It'll take another half a generation, whatever, until, intelligent design is presented, really, in our schools, and our children will be able to stand up and rebut the key catechetical attack, which is that Genesis 1 is not true, that God did not create man in his image and likeness, that man is really, as you put it, just the chance, random accident, as it were, of a biological process that began just eons ago. Our kids can't be certain about that, our children, the Catholic school students. They don't know how to defend it because they don't have this information. What can be done to rectify that while there's a time for this generation? Who wants to wait another generation while our children are having their faith devalued right in front of us?
Well, of course, we have to address the issue. We have to teach the controversy, number one. What is the controversy? Okay, that there are people who disagree, that doubt Darwin's theory. People that believe that there's another side of the story, the intelligent design side, believe that we should teach more about evolution, not less about evolution, more about evolution, so that people really understand what it is actually proclaims to be the mechanism to be true. Because the more you learn about it, the more weak it becomes. And therefore, secondly, of course, we're talking about Catholic schools and teaching Catholics. We should make sure that our catechesis on Adam and Eve and the creation doctrines are strong and firm, and that we're great and we're proud of those teachings. But there's not, we don't have a powerful God who created us, and then we have some knowledge of in that regard. We don't have a very believable God or a strong God. Thirdly, we believe that we should address these things with a touch of metaphysics. That our kids, we need to bring back Thomas Aquinas in high school, and we need to look at those metaphysical principles that give us confidence or even certainty, as the Catechism says, that God exists through human reason. And lastly, we believe that we should present intelligent design, that there is, that the weight of evidence in this point in history, that the weight of evidence demonstrates that the foundational features of the natural world are best explained by an intelligent cause, an intelligence, a designer, and as of course, as believers, we would know who that designer is. Intelligent design doesn't teach, doesn't try to proclaim what that intelligence is, where it comes from, whether it's multiple intelligence, multiple causes. There is no way to come up with a scientific theory on that. But as God revealed himself to us, we can put two and two together. And Catholics, of course, need to hear this message, and very few of them even know that there is this controversy going on. Well, they may have heard of the controversy, but they don't know the other side. They don't know the weight and the strength of the arguments. And it's time to let them see those sides and let Catholics make their own decision which way they're going to follow. Because right now, a lot of them are following the atheists, as the rise of atheism in the United States is dramatic and rapid, and our churches are emptying out. And you and I, of course, saw this latest article about the percent of Catholics attending Mass in our archdiocese is down to 20% of registered Catholics and dropping rather rapidly. It was 24% like 3 or 4 years ago. So we need to find a new way to address the challenges of the modern world to our students and to our Catholic brethren.
You know, I'm well aware, our listeners may not, that you've spoken on this subject. I'm sure they'd not find that hard to believe, in front of many audiences here in the United States, particularly in the eastern United States, and actually in Europe, northern Europe. You've even gone into the classrooms of of schools, I guess elementary schools. What kind of reaction do you get? And I'd like to get it from both the kids themselves, the students, and also their teachers when you present this information.
Well, the kids are always fascinated by it. The most recent time I gave it, they wanted me to come back. I wanted to hear it again. It was kind of the end of the day, and they were tired, and they were struggling to stay awake. They actually asked me to come back. They're fascinated by it. We all want to have reasons to believe, and science is king in our society today, our culture, and to have a scientific argument for God's existence is powerful. The teachers have always accepted it and have enjoyed it and thanked me for the presentation. Sometimes there's very long discussions, but it's always been, the bottom line is it's always been well received. The problem is, of course, that so many people have heard that there is no Adam and Eve in a Catholic setting, whether it be a lecture someplace or in a Catholic school. I have 9 kids, almost every one of them was taught in a Catholic school at some point in time that there is no Adam and Eve. And in higher education, of course, this is where people are picking this up, Catholics are picking it up, and then they're bringing it back into our lower schools, our high schools and grade schools. And a number of intelligent design scientists, as a matter of fact, were Catholics in Catholic schools and were taught in high school there was no Adam and Eve, and they became atheists. So this has a huge impact on our catechesis. You could make the argument that once you deny Adam and Eve and you say that that's a myth and that Genesis, you know, the whole Genesis, we know there's some allegory there, but the whole Genesis is wrong. There was no Adam and Eve and no original sin. That affects the Old Testament. Eventually, it affects Christ's miracles. You and I were at the World Meeting of Families, and I was struck every lecture that I sat in on. Now here, they're defending marriage and they're defending sexual morality over and over again in various ways there. And every single lecture that I was in got back to Adam and Eve, the authorship of marriage in the Garden of Eden, and therefore the sacredness of sexuality, the primary use of sexuality, all that sort of thing. You can't do it. It all falls apart. Theology of the body falls apart without Adam and Eve and the authorship of marriage. So we have a huge catechetical problem, and it comes from our inability to deal with this Darwinian evolution question.
You know, working on Madison Avenue, which I did for a number of years, I was fascinated to learn a truism that many up there are well aware of, and that is that the big lie is much easier to sell than many small lies. And the big lie, that you too can be gods, what the serpent had to say to Adam and Eve in Genesis, is not all that dissimilar from what he has managed to say to succeeding generations through Darwin, and that is that Genesis 1 is not true. You're taught that it's revealed truth, the Bible, sacred scripture, the Word of God. But I'm here to tell you that it's not true. There are scientific explanations as to how Genesis is just flat out wrong. So this big lie has gathered steam for 6 generations now, 6. And stopping it, nullifying, muting it, turning it around is obviously, you know, the work of probably at least one or more generations. But it is a big lie, and the big lie always has a devastating impact, doesn't it, on man and salvation?
No doubt about it, Brian. No doubt about it.
What kind of resistance do you get from adults when you give your talks? I'm sure many people who come are interested and open-minded, some even may be adherents of the intelligent design work. But when you get questions, what do people generally pinpoint as their point of resistance or confusion?
That's a good question. When I started this, of course, I've given probably close to 80, I've given this presentation, the one presentation on Darwinian evolution and intelligent design probably 80 times. And when I started, I had great fear that I would be asked questions I couldn't answer, you know, by scientists and what have you. But it's been actually very rare that I've had a really difficult, challenging question. Most people are very much amazed by the presentation, by putting it all together. People who have biology degrees, even PhDs, have come up to me and said, you know, I never thought of it that way. I'm not up to date. I haven't read those things. We never really discussed that, you know, these kinds of things. So it's always been positive, revelatory. Once in a while, somebody has a thought here or there that seems to be a challenge. And, of course, they want to know whether I'm saying things like macroevolution has been disproven. Of course, I'm not saying that. I'm not defending a young Earth. I'm not defending 6,000 years or seven literal days of creation. I'm only taking the science where it can take us. And it's at a point today where it can take us to the point where we can defend the atheistic foundational dogma of unguided random chance evolution. So that's my message. And I can't think of really right now, Brian, a real strong argument. I never really answered your question about, you know, what did defenders of Darwinian evolution say? A lot of times it's personal attacks. A lot of times it's silence. A lot of times it's misreading what's been being argued. Stephen Meyer wrote the book Darwin's Doubt. It's about an inch and a half thick a couple of years ago. And, of course, the people in that book, he was attacking Darwinian evolution, starting with the evidence from the Cambrian explosion. He was saying, look, in this book, I'm going to show you why Darwin's mechanism doesn't work. And I'm going to use evidence, not from creationists, not from intelligent design scientists, but from evolutionary believing scientists. And of course, that book created a whole lot of firestorm of debate and what have you. And Discovery Institute collected the whole series of debate back and forth and created a second book, which is about an inch and a quarter thick of just debating Darwin's Doubt. So there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of debate now taking place. But the bottom line is that they are not winning the argument, they being the defenders of Darwinian evolution, whenever they do engage in the debate. So I get your last question, Brian, but that, I wanted to go back to that other question.
All right, Tim, we're going to come back after a commercial break. I want to talk to you about something that people point to that John Paul II, the great John Paul II, said that they think caused some confusion on Darwinian evolution. So we'll do that when we get back. Right now we're going to break for a couple of commercials, and we're going to introduce a new sponsor of our recourse, McGuire Hayden Real Estate, a commercial real estate and investment firm based here in the Philadelphia region, actually in Conshohocken. And they are the sponsor for our shows in August. The company has been hailed as one of the Delaware Valley's most respected commercially integrated real estate investment and operating firms. And the principals, and I know this to be true, Jim McGuire and Tony Hayden, are highly accomplished businessmen and well-known benefactors of many Catholic causes in the Philadelphia Archdiocesan area and beyond. Their company owns and operates over 4 million square feet of what is widely considered to be Class A commercial real estate space in the Mid-Atlantic region. It's a balanced mix of environmentally friendly industrial warehouses and suburban office buildings. Tenants claim that McGuire Hayden are unusually good landlords, always willing to work closely with them to find and configure, and if necessary, reconfigure their commercial space to better fit their needs. Each of these two men, each principal, has a genuine commitment to Catholic education, which they, in fact, credit in large measure for their great success. Jim McGuire, in another lifetime, the famous insurance mogul, is one of the founding fathers of Cristo Rey, a Catholic high school for inner-city students. Jim's funded scholarships for over 3,000 young people. They are known as the McGuire Scholars. Jim's also the founder of the unique McGuire Hayden Intern Program for high school seniors whose families live below the poverty line. Each intern must work one day a week at McGuire Hayden in exchange for full tuition at a private K-12 Catholic High School. Tony Hayden is the co-founder and chairman of the board of Regina Angelorum Academy in Ardmore. He is, more importantly, a terrific husband and an outstanding father of five amazing young children. Regina Angelorum Academy offers an authentically Catholic classical education for over 130 students. It's 9 years old, pre-K through 8 grades. The Academy is part of the Regina Academies Network, and it will begin, as I say, its 9th year of operation this September. We should also note that McGuire Hayden provides jobs for over 20 men and women in this area, many of whom are graduates of Catholic schools. They are an outstanding employer, an outstanding firm, and just a great benefactor of all things Catholic in the archdiocesan area. And we welcome them as a sponsor of our recourse, and we thank them for doing so.
Every experience God gives us, every person He puts in our lives, is the perfect preparation for a future only God can see. My name is Ann McGlone, and I am sharing this inspiration with you today during this powerful radio program in His Sign Catholic Radio Network, hosted by Kathleen McCarthy. The Lord called Kathleen to prepare us for a future only God can see. This is a program and a radio network which captures, elevates, inspires, and catechizes the hearts of all who listen. Kathleen is preparing hearts through this ministry as she ministers in hospital rooms privately, global conferences, and personal prayer times with individuals who listen and perfect strangers in the street. The Lord is inviting you today to become a faithful listener, for He wants you to set your heart on fire through this radio network. Are you willing to listen in the silence of your heart? This is the question the Lord is asking you. God bless you.
To you, our faithful family of listeners, no words can express how much we appreciate your standing in the gap with us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio. It is truly your amazing prayer power, your undaunting commitment that has enabled us to stay on the air, no doubt about it. Be assured of our daily prayers, not only for you, but for your families as well. We pray that God will continue to bless you as you bless us. To join us and become a ministry partner, visit our website at inhissign.com or give us a call at 610-527-2906.
Okay, we're back. I'm Brian Gale. This is Our Recourse. Our guest today is Tim Renane. We're talking about intelligent design, and we're talking about some of the reaction that Tim gets when he goes around and gives his talks here in Europe, and particularly in our schools, among the teachers and students. And I mentioned before we broke away that some who resist the truths of intelligent design, the theory and some of the empirical evidence of it, point to a statement or two by John Paul II, the great Pope, about his own take on evolution, and they use it as a reason perhaps not to embrace intelligent design. Tim, can you enlighten our listeners about what was said and what was meant?
Yeah, I think it was 1995 or 1996, I think it was, where the Pope made a presentation to the Pontifical Academy of Science. And that, of course, is a group of people who don't have to be Catholic. They're just people who have maintained or achieved a high level of credibility in the science community. A lot of them are not Catholic, and most of them are theistic evolutionists, if not all of them. And he made a presentation, and in that presentation he said something about the fact that it appears that evolution has reached a point where it's past the hypothesis, in other words, past the hypothesis stage. In other words, it seems to have achieved a credibility that we could now start talking about it more as a fact or as a proven theory or words to that effect. At least that's what it was taken as. That's not what he said. But it was seized upon as proof that he accepted Darwinian evolution, that the church accepted Darwinian evolution, and all that sort of thing. And, of course, none of that. Certainly the church has never accepted Darwinian evolution, even though people continue to claim it has. People will quote Pope Francis or Benedict XVI or, as we were just talking, John Paul II. Their comments have no weight of authority either in science or in theology. And when Cardinal Schoenhorn, a close friend of Benedict's and certainly John Paul as well, from the Cardinal of Arch of Vienna, Austria, he wrote his famous letter in 2005. He mentioned that statement and said it was insignificant. What the Pope said, it didn't have any authority whatsoever. But it continues to be seized on and speculated on, and it's by itself, in and of itself, it's fairly meaningless.
Can you fathom what he meant when he said it's past the point where it's beyond just theory? I know,
that's what he was implying. He didn't actually say it in those words, but no one really quite knows. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories around it that he never even made the presentation, or somebody else wrote it for him, or it's hard to know. And it was never addressed by. Certainly by the Pope, it was just left that way. John Paul, of course, we know from Theology of the Body, all his writings, that Adam and Eve are absolutely critical to the development of the Theology of the Body that the Pope spent so much time on. So there was can never be any question that he doubted Adam and Eve or the creation of man and woman or anything like that. I think that that point we can move on past that particular one point. There's a great book called Catholicism and Evolution where Michael Shabarek, he's a Dominican priest, lays out the history of the Catholic Church's discussion of the theory of evolution from Darwin all the way up even to Pope Francis, and he has a big section on John Paul II. A lot on Benedict XVI, who has been very, very active in this issue from the time he was in the 1970s at after the Second Vatican Council, and he seems to have evolved, if I can use that term, from a very liberal theistic evolution point of view towards a much more conservative, intelligent design point of view. And just before he was made Pope. In 2004, he wrote a book called Truth or Tolerance, and in there he addressed this issue. And he said that this dispute between evolution and design has to be approached objectively with a willingness to listen by both sides. So he was definitely kind of moving in that direction. As soon as he became Pope, the very next summer, he put on that famous summer institute at Castle Gandolfo, where they discussed evolution. Cardinal Schoenhorn was there. And the Pope and a lot of the former students of the Pope, and in the conclusion, in the conclusionary remarks of Benedict XVI, he basically told the leading evolutionary scientist there from Vienna that, again, you don't know what the mechanism is. You don't know how it works. You've admitted that large leaps are necessary, not the small changes that Darwin talked about, which, you made that reference earlier in our conversation here, Brian, that Darwin said if somebody could do that, then there would be no theory left. And that's exactly what the Pope said at the end of the conference when in his summer remarks, he said, you've now talked about leaps. We have to leap from one creature to another, or we have to leap by huge chunks of information from one thing to another, because small changes just don't get the job done. When it's all taken together, there is no evidence that the church has made any kind of proclamation that theistic evolution is a philosophy of the church or the way the church should think or does think. The debate goes on, the battle goes on.
Have you ever found a bishop that was willing to sit with you and just talk openly, even if confidentially, about this?
Well, there are bishops that are known to be very interested in the subject. Whenever I've tried to approach our local ordinary or people that I know like that, of that kind of power, they usually don't want to talk about it. They say it's too controversial. They don't feel there's anything they can do about it, and they don't engage the conversation. So that's at the highest levels, but that doesn't mean there's not plenty of priests and decision makers in the church that aren't interested in this topic and aren't reading a lot about it and don't love to talk about it. I've certainly had that experience, but getting to the point where a bishop would encourage or mandate an open discussion or a change in catechesis or a change in the science curriculum in a Catholic school, that hasn't occurred yet.
You know, how about even just a presentation of both as theories? Just use the word in each case, Darwinian theory, intelligent design theory, even though there's scientific truth that underlies the latter, and present those, prepare the teachers to learn of it and present it just on the chance that intelligent design may in fact prove to be true, and the absence of it being taught allows the error and the attack on our children and their catechetical formation to be perpetuated. Would there be any reason why they simply just couldn't present both?
No, of course not. Of course not. In Catholic schools, that is it's common sense, really. I believe it's common sense, and I think in a generation from now, if not before that, we'll look back at this point, this turn in history, and of course the previous 50 years, and we'll say that exactly what you just said is just common sense. When most people finally understand what's being discussed here and what's being recommended, they say, well, sure, that's common sense. Why would anybody object to that? In fact, whenever the American people have been surveyed and asked whether both sides of the story should be presented in public school, close to 80% of Americans, whether they're liberal, Democrats, Republicans, or conservatives, 80% say, well, of course, sure, why wouldn't we present both sides of the argument? Teach the controversy. Let us see. Let the kids decide. Let them see the evidence pro and con. Now, in that regard, of course, they're talking about the pro and con on Darwinian evolution. There's the other piece of it, which is there evidence for intelligent design? There doesn't appear to be any evidence for unguided evolution, but there is a lot of evidence for an intelligence behind the complexity and the design of the cell, an intelligence behind the creation of the universe, whether it be the Big Bang or the physical constants or the possibility of life being found anywhere in the universe. Intelligent design, the universe just screams intelligent design, as Father Robert Spitzer defends in his works from a cosmology point of view.
You know, I can detect the finger of God at work in a providential design in the education of the Catholic child. You know, we have all these neoclassical, what I'll call neoclassical, Catholic schools, academies that are being founded, of course, Regina Academies here in the region, but the Chesterton Academies in the middle of the country, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and that general region, and of course others. I think there's 65, 75, something like that across the country.
There's now 100, apparently, according to the conference that we had here in Philadelphia.
100 Catholic academies.
1.5% of all Catholic schools are now classical schools.
What percent is that?
1.5% of all Catholic schools are now classical, and it's the curve curve is steep. It, you know, it's still only 100, but it was only 75 two years ago. So it's certainly catching on and spreading, and people are realizing that Catholic education in general is just not getting the job done, and we need a new model. And this is certainly one of them. The classical approach is certainly one of the models that's catching on very rapidly.
Well, you know, I was thinking that the classical model, to be authentically classical, opening the children's minds to the great thinking of ages past, from antiquity on through the Middle Ages, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the modern period, postmodern, all of that, to be authentically classical, it seems to me they'd have to find ways to defend Genesis, if they're authentically Catholic as well. And here, postmodern science has really handed them a great tool. Is it possible that these very new modern Catholic classical academies may be a delivery mechanism for mainstreaming a new biomolecular design that disproves Darwinian evolution?
Well, I certainly hope so. Our board, of course, has been discussing this issue and how and when we can initiate such a program in our schools, and it looks like it is going to be in the very near future. Certainly, Thomas Aquinas believed in intelligent design. People will try to argue that he didn't, that he would have been a theistic evolutionist, but but his writings were very, very clear. And we do teach philosophy in high school in the classical curriculum. In fact, all 4 years, there's some philosophy. Thomas Aquinas and Augustine will be front and center, and their thoughts on the issue will be compatible with what we could teach in the science class, and then back to the theology class. It's three legs of a stool. You know, the church has this rich tradition of metaphysics and philosophy. But in today's world, of course, is largely ignored. But here along comes intelligent design science theory, which is very, very compatible with the metaphysics piece. The two can work really well together and then align themselves with the theology class, which, of course, is where God revealed the truth to us. And we're getting more and more tools all the time to defend that truth. So that's the good news.
Well, you know, the umbrella for that was the great first line of the great John Paul II encyclical, Fides and Ratio, where he said, faith and reason are the two wings upon which man takes flight.
Well, that sure sounds familiar.
And he pointed out that they can't be in opposition to each other.
Right.
They must be
right.
Complementary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that the case, where we see... modern science, reason, really proving in every way the fullness of the truth of sacred scripture and faith as it begins to be unveiled and revealed in Genesis 1.
Yeah, exactly. There's a book called God and Evolution, which is a landmark book in this whole debate. It's not so much the science of intelligent design, but more the philosophical challenges to it. At the beginning of the book, it's written by six or eight authors. It addresses theistic evolutionists, and then it addresses evangelicals, and then there's about four chapters addressed to Catholics and Catholic metaphysicians who may be objecting to one piece or another of intelligent design. Of course, intelligent design is science, but of course it has some philosophical implications. It has theological implications, and people seem to be uncomfortable with it because it's new. But a guy by the name of Logan Gage writes in that God and Evolution, one of the chapters to Catholics, and one of my favorite quotes in the book where he says, the dismissal of intelligent design by some contemporary Thomist is unfortunate. If reality is a unified whole, that is, if it stems from the divine mind as Thomas believed, would it not be odd if good philosophy concluded that life is designed, but good science concluded that life was not? And that's, I think, a great summary of where we are in this debate.
Absolutely brilliant. And, you know, it's not a small irony that some of the leaders at the Discovery Institute in the whole field of intelligent design happen to be Catholic, faithful Catholics, and their example seems to be drawing their non-Catholic, in many cases Christian, fellow travelers to the Catholic faith. You know, even though the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, has not been very, let's say, open to the truths that they are all unveiling.
Yeah, some very brilliant people. Judge Bork, for example. You remember old Judge Bork and his struggles to get onto the Supreme Court. He became a Catholic towards the end of his life, and he credited intelligent design theory for that conversion. Another guy who was similar to Dawkins, really, in his philosophical atheism, a guy by the name of Anthony Flew, wrote a book that that declared that he had become a theist. Not so much, I don't know if he ever made the path all the way to Christianity, but he became a theist. And it was because of intelligent design and what it was presenting. So for those that have an open mind, it has conversionary power. There's no doubt about it.
Who was the great botanist that's such a herald, you know, from Dartmouth, I think? He's a non-Catholic Christian. I don't know that he was always even a believer. But he has expressed great interest in the Catholic Church. The more he delves into the reality of life and Mendel and, you know, these biomolecular discoveries. And it seems to me that he's being drawn ever closer to the Church, whether she regards his work as valid or not. He regards her as really the full repository of truth knowable to man. What's his name?
Give me, Brian, I'm not quite sure.
This is the guy from Dartmouth University. You had him at one of your seminars a couple of years.
You're talking about Cornell, Cornell University. That's John Sanford you're talking
That's
about, right?
That's it. Yeah, I mean, he expressed, I remember him expressing great interest in the Catholic faith. I mean, he was asking really hard probing questions. It was clear that something was astir within him, and he was not a Catholic by any means. And I think his backstory was that at a certain time in his life, he wasn't actually even a believer. But here, through this scientific discovery of all things, he's being drawn to the truth, and he's seeing that the brightest flame of truth, the fullest flame of truth, actually seems to reside in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I don't know if he would has made that step yet. I haven't talked to him in several years, but he was certainly very, very interested. He was an atheist most of his life. He's a very famous scientist and a very rich one because he created a biogenetic firm and sold it to DuPont. And because he was the guy who created a lot of the ability through patents, of course, to genetically modify the genes of our food plants, our soybeans and corn and that sort of thing. So if you don't like genetically modified food, you have him to blame. But he became very rich, and he started out by trying to mutate these plants with x-rays and things like that, and found it was totally useless, that there's no way you could mutate them into anything different or new. So he developed techniques where he could actually modify the genes, turn a gene off so that it could fight off a particular fungus or disease or be unpleasant for insects to be around or whatever. And of course it created the ability to double and triple yields of fields and feed millions and millions of more people, and of course he became rich and famous. But he was losing his faith. He was losing his marriage. His wife said, "Can we go down to that little Christian church down there? Maybe they can give us some advice." And the bottom line is, he became a Christian. He looked at his life's work, and he opened his eyes. The scales fell, and he said, "My life's work doesn't prove evolution to be true," which is what he formerly thought. but it proves that it's impossible. And that's his position today, that Darwinian evolution is impossible. One of the most decorated men in science, you know, in the last 50 years or so. So, it has the power, that's for sure.
You know, what that proves to me is that anything is possible for those who are open to true pursuit of truth.
Right, truth. Right.
And if you're open to it, and if you pursue it, sacred scripture and even our modern history is littered with the great lives of men and women who have pursued truth to its logical end and found in that truth the source of all life.
No argument there, Brian.
Well,
exactly.
I think what we've got, Tim, is a great mission for our time, because if we're going to turn this catechetical problem around, we're going to have to embrace the truth that's being revealed to us now through science, and that's going to lead us ultimately to teach our children how to defend the faith and the attacks on it from science. And that's not going to happen unless this intelligent design body of work is presented to them in a fair way and they are encouraged to be open to it.
I agree, Brian. I think that it affects the way we think about the Bible, the way we think about the body, the way that we think about sexuality, the way we think about marriage, and all these things are critical catechetical issues that are affecting our young people. And when they go off to college and they try to profess their faith, people laugh at them, that your faith is a fantasy. So we have to address it. We just can't rely on the sentimentality that's in the faith or the emotion, or wasn't Jesus a wonderful teacher and wasn't he unique and let's just follow Jesus. Well, he may not have been divine, but that's not important. You know, this is how things have devolved in Christian thinking, because of Darwin's theory being taken as fact, as truth, instead of investigating it and keeping an open mind about it.
Well put, Tim. Really appreciate you coming on again and taking the time to share all of that wisdom and that truth with our listeners. I want to remind everyone that In His Sign Network is a great work of the new evangelization, and I would encourage everyone to support it in every way that they can, financially and, of course, through their prayers, and to also, in any way that can be possible, to support the good work of McGuire Hayden Real Estate. They are our sponsors, and they are outstanding people, and they have done so much and continue to do so much for Catholic education here in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank again our wonderful guest, Tim Murnane, and we want to hope everyone here has a wonderful week, and we hope to see you back here next Monday. Thank you very much.
News travels to our enemies. Their spies are everywhere. A runner will already have left with word that you've assembled your troops.
Yes.